Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm joined this week for a very special discussion of Tim Burton's 2010 remake, reimagining, reboot, prequel, postquel, sequel, requel of Alice in Wonderland by the most frabjous guy I know, Heath Holland.
Well, hello, Patrick. I'm wearing all sorts of prosthetics right now, and I've got an orange wig on, and I'm doing my dance. And
It sounds almost like Boris Karloff doing the Mad Hatter.
Oh, that would be so awesome if he was.
Let's start rewriting this movie now and save ourselves some heartache. We're going to be talking about Alice in Wonderland in a little bit. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, welcome. We have a website. It's fthismovie.net. Go check it out. We have stuff up there every day. You can follow us on Twitter at fthismovie. Like our page on Facebook. Email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Find us in the iTunes store or listen to us on Stitcher. If you're somebody who gets your podcast through Stitcher, we are available through that as well. Heath.
Yes, sir.
Have you seen anything good lately?
I have. I've had a really good run lately.
Are doing better than me.
Oh, well, I did until I didn't, but we'll get there. Okay. I watched, let's see, I'll start, I guess, chronologically. This Turner Classic Movies showed this movie called Big City Blues from 1932. Are you familiar?
I am not.
It is a Joan Blondell, I guess, vehicle, but it's also the first appearance of Humphrey Bogart in a Warner Brothers movie.
Oh, right on.
And for some reason, it's never made it to the DVD, as the kids call it. And so I've never seen it, but I caught it, and I thought it was pretty great. And I like Joan Blondell. I think she's feisty.
I don't think I don't know if I've ever seen a movie with her.
Really?
If I have, I'm not aware of it.
I tell you to check it out, but I don't know how you would do that.
Because, yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, it's like we live in this day and age where everything is, you know, like on demand, or this one's not. It was on VHS, but it never made it to DVD, so I don't know. This guy from Indiana goes to New York City, and it's like all happy-go-lucky in 30s, you know, and it's like, hey, I want to New York City, say? And then all of a sudden somebody gets killed at a party that Humphrey Bogart's at with, like, this girl falls on a broken bottle, and then it just gets kind of nasty from there. But I thought it was really good. And Humphrey Bogart, young, but That guy's got something. I think he's going places.
He might. Let's see what happens. Let's see how it shakes out.
Okay. I don't want to jump the gun on that one. I watched a documentary called The Adventures of Errol Flynn. This is on the Errol Flynn Signature Collection, Volume 1, I think. Might have been done by Turner Classic Movies as well. I'm not sure. But they managed to cover the man's career and his proclivities without being X-rated. So Good for them on that one.
They should have just put out Errol Flynn porn.
Yeah.
There's a new movie out, and I don't remember what it's called, which sucks. Kevin Klein plays Errol Flynn. Susan Sarandon plays the mother of his young lover. And now I can't remember who his young lover is played by. So you keep talking, and I will find out that information.
I am intrigued. Okay, next, I watched a noir from 1950 called Gun Crazy. Have you heard of this one?
Gun Crazy, I've seen.
Okay. I was impressed with Gun Crazy.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
John Dahl and Peggy Cummins. And it's got this great one-shot scene where they're going to rob a bank. And so the camera's in the back of this car. It was like they hollowed out a Cadillac, like a stretch Cadillac, put the camera in the back of it. So they're driving down the main street and, like, pull into a parking spot in front of the bank. Guy goes into the bank, and a cop walks around the corner. So the woman gets out and talks to him, kind of distracts him. And then the guy runs out. She clocks the cop, and then they get back in the car, and then it's like a high-speed chase. All same shot. 1950, I was really impressed. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, I remember feeling like it was a movie that felt very much ahead of its time, which is probably not fair. I think I just sometimes I have ideas, or especially used to have some ideas about like what old movies are like, and then you see one that isn't doesn't fit that preconception of what you think old movies are, and you're like, yeah. Oh my gosh, they were doing this kind of stuff back then, which is always exciting. But
going back to that Joan Blondell movie, that was like, I guess the Hays Code was in effect, but it was apparently not being cracked down on because it has some stuff in there. I was like, wow, saucy. So like the cops interrogating people that were at the party. And he's like, did you see this woman? We have reports of a woman. He's like, well, I only saw her from the back, but I will remember that back or something like that. I was like, wow.
She had a very nice back. That's all he meant.
Shoulder blade.
A good arch to it. Right. So the movie, by the way, which supposedly came out in the United States late last year or last fall, kind of. It's called The Last of Robin Hood, and Dakota Fanning plays Errol Flynn's young lover. Kevin Kline is Errol Flynn. Susan Sarandon is her mother.
And now, did you see this?
Max Casella is in the movie as Stanley Kubrick.
Who is Max Casella?
He was Doogie Howser's best friend.
Oh, yeah.
So now I want to see it just to see him play Stanley Kubrick. I'm not, I'm going to sound ignorant right now, but I don't know the connection between Errol Flynn and Stanley Kubrick.
Well, I'm sure there was one. They wouldn't put it in the movie if
it was. Well, that's what, but it wasn't covered in this documentary that you saw?
No, it wasn't. They must have left that part out. Maybe that was one of the more provocative things that they just, you know, would have old ladies clutching their chest. Didn't Kevin Kline in The Chaplain, the Richard Attenborough, he was Douglas Fairbanks, wasn't he?
Yes.
Okay. So he's just working his way through all the...
It's all just mustache casting. I really believe that it's purely... And I mean, he seems right to play both of those actors, so it's kind of a no-brainer, but at the same time, it does seem like mustache casting.
Yeah, absolutely. Should I move on?
Keep going. Yeah, no, keep going.
All right, I'm interested to see if your ears perk up on this one. So I watched a 1967 beach movie, one of the last ones, called It's a Bikini World.
I have not seen It's a Bikini World.
Oh, this is another one that's not on DVD. So
this doesn't come from the like AIP cycle, does it?
AIP produced it. I'm sorry, AIP distributed it, but they didn't make it. It's like Trans World.
Okay.
Something like that.
All right.
And it's... what's the guy? Tommy Kirk, the guy from those Disney movies from the 50s. He was in Old Yeller, and he was in Swiss Family Robinson. So okay. He's the guy. And Deborah Wally's in it. She's in a couple of those other beach movies. Sid Haig, okay?
Right on.
As like an Ed, Big Daddy Roth kind of guy who's driving around a custom car. And the plot's thin, you know, but they always are. So it's just kind of an excuse for... Okay, so Tommy Kirk likes this girl. And through some plot contrivance, ends up pretending to be his own nerdier brother. Twin brother. So he's got the glasses on and everything. And they have... So what I liked about this movie is it had a skateboard race. I don't think I've ever seen a skateboard race in a movie from that time period. Right. Is that you've seen a lot more beach movies than me. Skateboard races?
The skateboard was invented in 1955 by a gentleman named Martin McFly. So right. I guess it had been around for about a decade at that point.
Right. And Martin McFly's dad would go on to serve the Queen of Hearts in... I'm getting ahead of ourselves right now. Let's see. Did I have anything else I wanted to say about
that? How does one see It's a Bikini World?
It came on broadcast, like Antenna.
Oh, right on.
One of those channels that's like, they just play like stuff that nobody wants to show.
Yeah. That's how I saw part of a movie called Sergeant Deadhead, which is like an AIP movie that Frankie Avalon made. And I think that's part of why he left the Beach Party series, or that's like kind of what he made after he left the Beach Party series. And a bunch of the people from the Beach Party movies show up in this movie, Sergeant Deadhead. They even stopped, Jody McCrae played a character in the original Beach Party movie called Deadhead. And then all of a sudden, about three or four movies in, they started calling him Bonehead because they wanted to use the name Deadhead for the title of this other movie. The point is this. I caught a couple minutes of it in broadcast. I was like, what is this movie? I need to see it. And it's one of those happy accidents where like there's a movie that you really want to see. You're trying to track it down and you type it in and it like it shows up on Netflix Instant, or this was on Amazon Prime Instant Video. So it was like, I don't even have to track down a DVD. I don't have to find the movie. It's just here. And that's a great feeling when there's a movie that you're searching out that, like, yeah. Oh my gosh, it's on Netflix Instant. This is so great.
And now, like, YouTube catches all that stuff, but they haven't caught It's a Bikini World yet.
I have a frustration with Amazon Prime Instant Video. Some of these movies that I have sought out show up on there, which is great because they're real obscure. But they are in, like, sub-VHS transfers. Mm-hmm. And I haven't had that experience much on Netflix. I feel like everything on Netflix has been pretty watchable.
Yeah.
And for whatever reason, some of the stuff I've been finding on Amazon is, like, I can't even watch it. Some of, like, the spaghetti westerns and stuff that show up on there, I try to put them on, and they're unwatchable because the transfers are so bad.
Do you know if any of those spaghetti westerns have better, like, German DVD releases or anything?
I don't, no.
Because a lot of times, that's, like, the best there is.
Yeah.
Like, they show what they have because it's kind of lost. But then you'll look at something, and it'll pop up. It'll be like, oh, here's a German DVD with a commentary track from the actors, and it's like, but you have to have the region free player, and then you have to import the thing.
Right.
All I'm saying is, if you want to see a Bikini World, we can talk.
All right.
It is out there. Let's see. Was there anything? Oh, okay. We don't have to talk about this for a long time, but my Transformers boycott of Age of Extinction has come to an end.
Why?
I would like to thank everyone who sent their thoughts and prayers my way, and who sponsored me through the time of tribulation.
Walk us through the process, because how do you decide to, like, pull the trigger on, all right, I'm going to see this movie finally?
Well, Black Friday, the Blu-ray, was really cheap. So I didn't want to put money in anybody's pocket with it. So I was like, well, if it comes on TV and I can check it out, or if it's at Redbox or something. But Black Friday, it was really cheap. And so I bought it with the intention of saying, like, well, no one's making money off of this, which I'm sure they did. But I was like, you know, no one's making money off of this. And I don't have to watch it. Now it's just an option. And if I ever want to pull the trigger on it, it's right there. All I have to do is put it in.
Right.
So I did make it all the way from Black Friday to, like, last week. So I held out for a long time. And then just, like, thinking about Transformers and, like, being in an 80s cartoon kind of mood and, like, revisiting some stuff that I want to write about. And I'm just like, you know, maybe because it 3 seemed like it might have been on an uptick. And I know that Shia LaBeouf's not in this one. And so maybe I should pull the trigger on it. And I did. And I'm not happy with myself.
No.
I'm not proud. The best I can say is that, like, it's not as bad as I thought it would be. It's not the worst thing ever.
Okay.
But
I agree with that. I mean, I think it's a garbage movie that is also not the worst thing ever.
We're going to have to revisit this later on in our conversation for Alice in Wonderland, because there's something that I think applies to Transformers that applies to a lot of movies that are coming out right now. But do you know the scene that you may have put this in your review? I don't remember. There's the beginning of the movie. Marky Mark is walking through his little whatever it is, and there's this old man, and he's like, "They don't make movies like they used to make movies."
Yes,
and
they do.
A John Wayne poster, and he's like, "Now that was a movie." And then the guy behind him, it's the comedian. What's this guy's name? Shoot.
The old man was Richard Reilly, but I can't remember who the young guy was.
I can't remember.
I vaguely remember the scene.
The younger guy goes, don't mind him, he's senile.
Right.
Or something like that. And the joke, in quotes, is that this guy doesn't think they make movies. It's like wink, wink at the audience, assuming that everybody who's at your movie thinks that the classic movies are garbage and that this is the way to go, with no allowance for the fact that, hey, you can like John Wayne movies and potentially like Transformers too, or like, you know, like Transformers as well. Like, or like, we don't even aspire to this. That's this isn't your dad's movie. This is...
Well, yeah, but at the same time, like, Michael Bay is such a psychotic, and this almost, like, warrants another conversation completely, but Michael Bay is such a psychotic that I'll bet he thinks he's on the side of the Richard Reilly character. Even though he's putting words in the mouth of, like, the young guy who's saying, don't mind him, he's senile, and, you know, those movies are old and for old people and senile people or whatever. I guarantee Michael Bay, who considers himself a real cinephile, sides more with the Richard Reilly character.
Really?
Which then, you know, has the movie mock him, and everything about his movie suggests that, no, he's not interested in old movies or good movies. He's interested in garbage like Transformers and is making a movie that adds to the downfall of civilization, but... I could be wrong. I could be wrong. I just, he's a crazy person with very little sense of self-awareness.
Yeah, it's, so the idea that that's like a self-deprecating joke never once occurred to me, because I think that he believes that he is the greatest thing in the world, and that he thinks that he's above everything else.
Oh, for sure. That actor's name is Patrick Bristow,
okay,
who is one of these guys that you would just recognize from 500 other things he was in. Pain and Gain. He is in so many things. I'm looking at his IMDb page right now. I mean, to me, he's best known as like the choreographer's assistant in Showgirls, because he's the guy on stage while the girls are auditioning, yelling, thrust it, thrust it, thrust it.
Okay.
And I believe that's what... that's what will be written on his tombstone. But
yep.
He's one of those guys that people would recognize if they saw him. But
okay,
yeah.
Well, I just I continue to not understand how these movies make money. How Transformers
the most money.
And if I'm not the target audience for a Transformers movie, who is? I mean,
yeah,
I'm willing to forgive. You know, like I go in with an open mind. I don't know if I did this time, but I have gone in with an open mind, wanting to like what I see. And it's like, here I am opining Transformers again. But it's like, no one who's making this movie, or who wrote this movie, or is involved in this movie, knows anything about Transformers. It's like they went to Target, and they're like, oh, that's those Transformers on that shelf there. We should write a movie about that. So they're robots, right? So they probably do robot things. It's like, you know, this franchise comes with clearly established characters who have, like, these rich histories that you could draw from, but, why bother?
No, they're pretty much, they're interchangeable. What, now, you've seen all four of them?
Yeah.
All right, can you rank them for me? This is very important.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, but you didn't know you were going to have to do this. I didn't know you saw this movie, so.
Well, I'm sorry.
I'm curious where you fall on this.
I'm sorry on multiple levels. I would say, let's see, I would say the first one is still probably the most watchable because it's the least, egregious in all of the sin.
It's the closest to being a real movie.
Yeah. 1, 3, 4, 2.
I would probably agree with that. Again, this is like, you know, ranking, injuries you've had. I might put 3 above 1, even though 3 is garbage, but like 3 has a few sequences that I kind of like, and I'm partial to the Chicago stuff.
Right.
But I mean, they all suck. 1 is definitely like almost a real movie, and I think that's because that's the one that Spielberg had the most part in kind of shaping. But 2 definitely the worst, 4 definitely the second worst, 1 and 3 pretty much interchangeable.
Yeah.
But now he swears he's done. I know he said he was done after 3 making these movies. Somebody else obviously will make another Transformers movie. It just won't be Michael Bay.
Yeah, and I still have hope, too, that whoever does do the next one will have affection for the franchise.
But like, what world is this? What society are we living in? What weird gluttons for punishment or slaves to our own nostalgia are we, where we're like, all right, maybe the fifth one they'll get it. Like, they've done 4 of these goddamn things, and we're still just like, I'm gonna hold my hopes out for the fifth one. I don't get
it. Yeah. Well, you know, like, looking at it optimistically, you think, well, maybe this is gonna be the next, I mean, okay, this is not a fair comparison, but you're like, well, maybe this is going to be the next Avengers, where somebody who really gets these characters comes in and has the budget to do the right thing and makes a great movie that we can all be on, you know, all get on board with. But that hasn't happened. Mm. And, but, you know, here's another question, though. If they made not Avengers, but something else, like Guardians of the Galaxy turned out really well, but at some point, these studios are going to make a movie based on a property that they think people really love, and it's not going to be good, and people are probably going to flock to it anyway and swear that it's the best thing ever. That's probably happened 5 or 10 times. I don't want to make anybody...
It's definitely happened 5 or 10 times.
I'm not going to make anybody mad at me by picking anything out. But, you know, but like...
Yeah.
Like, what if Avengers 3 comes out, and the person who makes Avengers 3 has never read an Avengers comic book, he didn't watch Avengers 1 or 2, and he's just like, I mean, I feel like I know who these guys are just from pop culture, right? You got, like, the guy with the American flag on his chest, and then you got the other guy who's, like, in a robot suit, you know, and he's, like, got weird facial hair. I mean, I got this. I can do this.
Yeah.
I feel like that's where we're getting. And on that happy note, I'm done.
In many ways, we are there. I will try to go quick with mine so we can get right into the Alice in Wonderland.
I talked too long about Transformers.
No, it's fun. So I saw a movie called Messiah of Evil, which is, shoot, I had it pulled up here and then I lost it. So it's Gloria Katz and Willard, I'm going to mess up his name, Hike, the husband and wife writing directing team. They wrote American Graffiti.
Oh.
Then they wrote Temple of Doom.
Right.
Then they wrote and directed Howard the Duck. And then things seem to have stopped for them. So obviously they were in tight with Lucas.
After Howard the Duck, things went downhill.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah. So 1973, they wrote and directed this weird horror film that I don't even know how to describe. I can barely tell you what the plot is. But, you know, in the last year or so, I have grown much more accepting, almost affectionate towards certain kinds of horror films that embrace a different kind of narrative. One might say less of a narrative, that are more sort of dreamlike in their approach. And there was a long time where I just didn't have the patience for those kinds of movies. I'd be like, what's the story? Who are these characters? I don't have time for this. And maybe it is my newfound affection for the Italian exploitation cinema, but I'm more accepting of that. So watching something like this, which was not Italian, it's American, while the story wasn't much of anything and the characters weren't necessarily people that I understood, it didn't matter, because every few minutes you would get this crazy new sequence or set piece that was, you know, very beautifully made and kind of unsettling or disturbing in ways that you couldn't, you know, sometimes this really crude stuff is the stuff that really gets under your skin. And it's not that it's crude, but it's like people trying to make something very ambitious and technically polished that they don't quite have the means. And so that disconnect is interesting to me, and particularly unsettling. There's a really great scene in a movie theater, and it was recommended to me. Again, this is one of these movies that I heard about on Killer POV, and it's out on... There's several different versions that are out on DVD, and I think they're kind of bad copies. And so what they had said on Killer POV was, the only way to see this really is on Blu-ray, but apparently it's put out by this company called Code Red. Are you familiar with Code Red?
I don't think so, no.
So Code Red is one of these boutique labels that does like 1,000 copy runs of all of these movies, and once they sell out, then you're just screwed. You know, maybe you pay way too much on eBay. It doesn't seem like they really announce street dates all that much. You just kind of have to luck out.
Okay.
So, Messiah of Evil, I hear them talk about it. I'm like, oh, I really want to see that movie. Obviously, I need to see it on Blu-ray. So, I go to Code Red. It sold out, you know, like a lot of, I think, all of their other titles. And then about a week or so later, I just happened to try it again. And this time, I got one. So, it's almost kind of luck of the draw, whether or not you're going to get one. And I lucked out and I got one. So, if you're able to see it, a good-looking transfer of it, I think it's worth your time. It's certainly not a movie for everyone, but I found a lot to like in it.
But now the disc you bought, it does look good. It's a good transfer.
Yeah, I mean, it's as good as it's going to be. I mean, it still looks washed out and scratched up and stuff, but very, very watchable. I mean, I have no complaints. Okay. Along those same lines, I also saw for the first time a movie called Massacre Mafia Style, a.k.a. Like Father, Like Son, which has just come out on Blu-ray from Grindhouse Releasing. And it is the first film written and directed by Duke Mitchell, who was this nightclub singer who had a long career as kind of an entertainer, made a movie once in the 50s called Bela Lugosi Meets a Brooklyn Gorilla. And it's actually available as a bonus feature on the Blu-ray, which is really cool. I haven't watched it yet, but he had a partner, and I don't know the partner's name. If JB was here, obviously he would know the name of the partner right off the top of his head. He and his partner had this act, and it was basically they were doing Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin.
Oh, this is the knockoff Martin Lewis.
One of them, yeah. Sammy Petrillo was the other one. So Sammy Petrillo was the fake Jerry Lewis. And they ended up getting sued, basically, or Jerry Lewis kind of threatened, you know, to sue them, and so they broke up their act. So Duke Mitchell is getting up in age. This was made in the mid to late 70s, and he passed away. He was 55. He passed away maybe 5 or 6 years later. So he was, I guess, about 50 when he made it. And the way I described it, so I had watched it and I was going to review it for DVD Verdict. Actually, I did. You can go to DVDverdict.com and read my review. And the way that I opened the review was by saying that Massacre Mafia Style is what The Room would be if The Room were any good. And I think that wasn't the best way to express myself, because I know people see The Room and they automatically think that, okay, so it's campy and terrible and we watch it to laugh and haha, it's so bad that it's good. And that's fine. People like The Room for that reason. But that's not what I meant. What I meant was, when you see The Room, have you seen The Room?
No.
Are you familiar with The Room?
No.
Oh my gosh. Okay, this is a separate conversation.
Maybe I am, if you tell me a little bit more about it. The name doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. We can't even go into it. Tommy Wiseau is this East European guy who decides he wants to make a movie, makes a movie called The Room, becomes known as one of the worst movies ever made, and experiences a rich second life as kind of a midnight cult movie. Okay. People love it now because it's so bad, and they get together and watch it, you know, ironically. It has joined the ranks of Plan 9 from Outer Space and Troll 2 as sort of this terrible movie that people love to goof on. And Tommy Wiseau has embraced it, claimed that he was deliberately making a comedy. That is completely untrue. His star, Greg Sestero, I want to say, and I might have his name wrong, wrote a book about it called The Disaster Artist, and Greg Sestero actually is in at least one of the Puppet Master movies, kind of the middle, one of the middle Puppet Master movies.
Okay.
Wrote a book called The Disaster Artist about his relationship with Tommy Wiseau, and like every Tommy Wiseau was somehow independently wealthy, raised all this money, and was shooting every scene with multiple cameras, whether he needed to or not. Like, I think one was a 16 or possibly even a 35 millimeter film camera, but then he was also shooting it with video. I don't know. So it's crazy. Anyway, what comes through in The Room for me, which is funny for a little while, and then it just gets old, you know, watching something just to laugh at it, even though I think the movie has an ability to top itself for its own craziness. What comes through in The Room when I watch it is Tommy Wiseau, for his total lack of ability to make a good movie, there's so much weird passion that comes through. Like, you feel like this guy had to make this movie. He had to get this out. And that's what I felt like watching Massacre Mafia Style, which is a much better movie and super watchable. And it's just, you know, a gangster movie. It's real violent. And again, it plays like a super crude 16 millimeter version of The Godfather, you know, but you watch it and you're like, oh, this guy, Duke Mitchell, just had to get all of this out, and he goes on these big long monologues about the Italian American experience and the old world.
Sounds amazing.
It's really worth seeing. Grindhouse releasing just put it out on Blu-ray. It looks unbelievable on Blu-ray. And I think next week they're releasing his second film. He only made two films. His second movie is called Gone with the Pope and was unfinished. He shot a bunch of footage and then I think he died. And it was like laying around in the garage of Duke Mitchell's kid or something. And Bob Murawski from Grindhouse Releasing got in touch with him and the kid said, yeah, you're welcome to it, you know, if you want to try to do something with it. So they went in and basically reconstructed the whole movie and finished it. So I'm really looking forward to seeing that. I don't know if it's going to be as good because it's not, you know, as pure an expression because Duke Mitchell didn't necessarily have a hand in editing it in the end.
Right.
But I think you would really like Massacre Mafia style. And maybe it's the kind of thing you say for Junesploitation, but I think it's really worth checking out.
Man, that sounds fantastic. I definitely will. I knew the other one was coming out, but now I have the context. But I now have the context of like who did that and what that actually is.
And Gone with the Pope. I mean, if you just heard that title, you would just have no idea what that even is. Yeah, like, I don't know what that means. The last movie I'll talk about, I'll try to be quick. Again, I feel like I could talk about this for a long time. So in the last week, I went kind of down a weird Bruno Mattei rabbit hole. And Bruno Mattei is one of these Italian horror directors who is terrible. He had a long career. He made a lot of movies. None of them were very good. There's one called Rats, Knights of Terror that I would recommend just for the last scene. Like, if you can make it through that whole movie, it's worth it just for the last scene. So, you know, people rag on Fulci or Lamberto Bava or Umberto Lenzi or these guys who their movies, again, are crude and violent and gory and mean-spirited, and they're not great filmmakers, you know. They all put Bruno Mattei to shame because he's a hack on the level of, like, an Uwe Boll. And Uwe Boll, I think, is a better filmmaker than Bruno Mattei. So,
oh, wow.
I watched this movie that, again, I had to review for DVD Verdict called Island of the Living Dead. And it's not good. And I put it in and I was like, oh, this, what is this, from 1982? And I looked it up and it actually came out in 2006. It's just that poorly made and weirdly dated. But it sent me down this weird rabbit hole. One of Bruno Mattei's things is that he steals. He rips things off. So there's a scene in Island of the Living Dead that is basically shot for shot the famous eye being pulled towards the wooden splinter from Fulci's Zombie. He made a movie called Cruel Jaws that I believe just used clips from Jaws and can't be shown in the United States. I don't think Shout Factory or Scream Factory actually was going to try to put it out and then found out that they couldn't because it violates copyright, I think. So in 1989, he makes a movie called Shocking Dark. And it is a scene for scene, essentially character for character remake of Aliens. I mean, it's crazy how much it just rips off Aliens and is presented as its own movie.
But not in like a loving way, like those kids remade Raiders of the Lost Ark.
No, not really.
Like, this is my idea and I'm making this movie.
Basically, yeah. I mean, it felt like the characters in Be Kind Rewind, where it was just like, well, I want to make a movie, but I don't have any ideas, so I'll just do what that guy did. And he remakes Aliens. I mean, there are so many direct similarities. There's a Newt character. There's a Ripley character. There's the scene where the Newt character falls into the hole and goes, Ripley! Except here, I think it's like, Sarah!
Shipley.
Yeah, exactly. Here's the fascinating wrinkle, though, about Shocking Dark.
It gets better, okay.
It absolutely gets better. Shocking Dark is available to view on YouTube. If you are interested in checking it out, it never got a theatrical release in the United States. How could it? It was banned, basically, from being... It might have gotten a release. It wasn't allowed to carry its original title. So, scene-for-scene remake of Aliens. Guess what the original title was? Shocking Dark was not the original title.
I don't know.
Terminator 2. So this is 2 years before Cameron makes... the actual Terminator 2. So Bruno Mattei decides, I'll just call my movie Terminator 2. And it's a remake of Aliens, except the Bishop character is sort of a Terminator. And so for maybe two scenes in the movie, they are fighting, instead of aliens, they are fighting a Terminator. And time travel does factor in the last 10 minutes because
I have to see this.
I mean, it's so bad, but it's watchable because, like, Aliens is good and you're just fascinated by it. But, I mean, it's so incompetently made and badly acted even before the dubbing. You know, sometimes it's like you can't judge a performance because you know it's dubbed over by another actor. But here you can tell, even with their original voices, these were bad, bad actors. Yeah, Terminator 2. So they were not allowed to call it Terminator 2 in the United States. Go figure.
I don't know why.
Yeah, it's crazy, right?
That's ridiculous. Yeah, we got to do something about these regulations.
Freedom of speech, man. Just ask.
So what's on
Joseph
YouTube
Kahn.
Is shocking. Stepped on your joke. Go say it again.
No, don't worry about it. Shocking Dark. Yeah,
Shocking
it's
Dark.
It's on YouTube.
So YouTube lets them roll with it. See.
Yeah.
That's
unfortunately, you know, I don't necessarily like to watch movies on YouTube for a handful of reasons.
Oh yeah.
But when it's the only way to see some of these movies, I feel backed into a corner, which is so stupid, right? Then I just could say, like, well, I'm not going to see the movie. But I mean, I would see this movie if I could, if I, you know, was able to rent it or something. I would absolutely rent it. I'm not going to YouTube as a means of not paying for something.
Right, right. I think you need to let yourself off the hook because there are a lot of movies, like Big City Blues. If that movie was on YouTube, you should watch that thing on YouTube because it's better to see a movie that you will probably not get to see otherwise than to just skip and pass on it.
Well, I'll certainly look for it on Turner Classic Movies. They're good for that. They will put stuff on that... that you can't see anywhere else, you know.
I think you're safe with the Shocking Dark there because I don't think who could put that out?
I don't think anyone. I don't know. And I don't know what the fallout was at the time. I haven't done enough research. I mean, I can't believe that James Cameron didn't, like, file some sort of cease and desist or something. But
yeah, unless he thought it was just so, you know, like, so laughable.
Well, I think, like, ultimately, yeah, it's like, this isn't worth my time, you know. But, it's really, and he was working with Claudio Fragasso, who wrote and directed Troll 2. So the guy's already, you know, a punchline. And yet Fragasso ends up dissolving their partnership because he's like, this guy Mattei is too much of a hack, basically. I mean, it's like he's not creative enough. He has no vision. He has no ideas. So when the guy who made Troll 2 is like, this guy's just not up to my standards, ditches you. I don't know. You're doing something wrong or right.
I want to see this movie now.
Yeah, Shocking Dark. Let us take this discussion of bad movies and let us segue into Tim Burton's 2010 remake, sort of Alice in Wonderland. So this came about for two reasons. One, this past weekend, Disney released their live-action remake of Cinderella into theaters, directed by Kenneth Branagh. I have not seen it. It got pretty positive reviews. It made a boatload of money. I think it made about $70 million in its opening weekend. Very popular. And from what I hear, good. Good in a way that just tells the story, in a way that respects the story, and treats it, it's not trying to, like, subvert it. It's not trying to reimagine it. It's not doing a prequel to Cinderella. It's just, here's the story of Cinderella done by actors instead of animators. Two, it was announced last week that Tim Burton would now be directing a live-action remake for Disney of Dumbo. And so obviously this is where things are going, right? Maleficent makes crazy amounts of money despite being garbage. And so now we get the green light on a lot of live action Disney films. So Cinderella is already out. Dumbo is coming out. Beauty and the Beast has already been greenlit. Emma Watson will be playing in that. And I really was like, oh, it's all because of Maleficent, right? But I kind of forgot that just 5 years ago, we had Tim Burton's Alice in Wonderland. This was an insanely successful movie. This movie made over $1 billion worldwide, made over $300 million in the United States, and a large part of me thinks that that has to do with the fact that it was a 3D movie. It was really the first new 3D movie. I think I have this right, although Clash of the Titans might have been the actual first 3D movie. This was one of the first 3D movies to come out in the wake of Avatar. And one interesting fact that I found out when looking this movie up is that around 75% of its revenue, I believe, came from 3D screenings.
Okay.
And nowadays, I suspect that number would be almost directly inverted. I think 3D wore off so fast. So Avatar's so big, and people love it so much, and they're chasing that, that they go see Alice in Wonderland in 3D. 5 years later, I really think 3D usually accounts for maybe 30 to 40% of a film's revenue, that the people have kind of grown tired of 3D, or they kind of see through the gimmick. I did not see Alice in Wonderland in theaters. I saw it when it came out on Blu-ray. I had only seen it once until I had to rewatch it for this podcast. I say had to, despite the fact that this was my idea. And yeah, I know you just saw it for the first time, like, yesterday, right?
Yeah.
So I will let you begin this conversation.
Well, we own this movie. This is part of the collection because my stepdaughter loves this movie, and she was with us as we were watching it last night, and the credits are rolling, and she looks at me and she goes, "This is such a great movie." So I'm, like, peaked for it, even though I feel like I know what this movie's going to be, which is why I haven't watched it, because I know what this movie's going to be, and it's not for me. So we're getting into it and everything, you know, it's this, it's that. Now, look, I like Tim Burton. I don't know that I love him at this point, but I like Tim Burton. I'm a Disney guy. I will support Disney on most of their ventures, and I have apologized for Johnny Depp for many things that I probably shouldn't have. But I think that this movie is one of the worst movies I have seen from a studio like Disney probably ever. I cannot believe this thing got made.
I believe that it got made. For a lot of the reasons that I believe Maleficent got made. And I think the two movies have a lot in common, although I would give the edge to Maleficent in terms of being a better movie. Even though it's a movie I didn't really like, I think it's a better movie than Alice in Wonderland. I think it speaks to so many of the problems with sort of big budget studio filmmaking right now, whether it's our need to take an existing property and reimagine it so that this isn't your parents, you know, kind of what you were saying about this isn't your parents' Transformers. You know, this isn't your parents' Alice in Wonderland.
By the way, Transformers, the comedian I was trying to think of, TJ Miller.
Okay.
You know TJ Miller. Yeah, he's the guy that says he's senile.
Oh, but he's not Richard Reilly's kid.
No, I don't remember what the relationship was there, but TJ
Miller. Well, TJ Miller was, it was just Marky Mark's, like, friend, assistant, whatever.
Right.
Yeah. No, I'm sorry. TJ Miller's totally in that movie. I was imagining, because there was another, Richard Reilly had another guy with him, like a snotty, kind of an uppity guy who was.
Maybe that was the guy that said it. I thought it was TJ Miller.
I feel like it was that guy that said it.
I'm going to go back and watch it again.
Really think you should. I really think it's very much worth it.
Well, it's not your dad's Transformers.
And this is not your dad's Alice in Wonderland, you know? And so cast Johnny Depp, and it's just wall-to-wall, quote-unquote, visual effects. I mean, I just think, and yet, this has to have one of the worst scripts of any major blockbuster in the last 10 years.
Yeah, what script?
And I agree with you. I really do think this is one of the worst. I can't say the worst movies ever made, because obviously that's a huge statement, but it's certainly one of the worst, biggest movies ever made. You know, if you were to look, and this is like one of the 20 highest grossing films of all time.
I know.
And if you were to look at that list, and I don't have the list in front of me, this might be the worst of all of them. And I would actually put it below certainly three of the four Transformers, maybe even Revenge of the Fallen, but I don't know. I'd have to watch it again.
I would put it below Revenge of the Fallen. At least there's ideas in that, that there's a conflict that they have to get from here to here. I don't even, when Alice in Wonderland finished, I was like, what happened in that movie? Like, what was the narrative? And I really struggled to think about what it was and if there was one.
No, and I still don't even totally know what it is. I know that, you know, Alice invents trading with China. And I know that that's supposed to be a happy ending. That, like, ooh, yay, this beloved fairy tale character is going into the private sector. She's going into corporate America. Not America, obviously, but and becoming, you know, an imperialist. Not America, obviously, London. So when it's announced, like, Tim Burton is going to do Alice in Wonderland, on paper, I see how that makes sense. And Tim Burton has huge fans and defenders. I feel like some of those have kind of fallen off in recent years, and who could blame them? He's made a lot of bad movies. I am pretty lukewarm. I like some of his early movies. I don't think he's had a very good movie in a long time. I mean, Big Fish, I kind of liked. Sleepy Hollow might be the last movie of his that I sort of liked, you know, just hands down. I thought that was good. But he brings a certain sensibility, you know, and that has been his move for a while now, is let's take an existing property and Tim Burton it up. So we do Planet of the Apes, and we do Alice in Wonderland, and we do Dark Shadows, and we do one that I'm forgetting. I don't know. It doesn't matter. No. Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Exactly.
So we take existing properties and we make them Tim Burton's particular brand of shitty. And so when it's announced, I feel like I can imagine what that movie's going to be. It's really not for me, but okay. I mean, that, you know, the Disney cartoon certainly has a kind of demented, psychedelic visual sense. I understand what Tim Burton's going to bring to it. He casts Johnny Depp, he casts Helena Bonham Carter. But nothing could have prepared me for the fact that the movie doesn't even rise to that level of mediocrity, that it's somehow far worse than just that uninspired version of Alice in Wonderland that I just outlined, because it's kind of a sequel, right?
Yeah.
She went to Wonderland, she forgot it, it takes place in something called Underland, there's a battle, she wears a suit of armor, with the exception of I want to say something positive. Tim Burton, someone, whether it was Tim Burton or one of his people, had the sense to cast Mia Wasikowska. Okay? Now, she's not bad in this movie. She's not particularly good. It's not her fault. She is not given a character to play. So it's not like, well, she comes out of this movie unscathed or she shines through the material. I think she's fine. She's not the problem with the movie. I give him credit because she would go on to do, I think, a lot of interesting things and tends to be a bright spot in any movie that she's in. So every time she shows up, I think, oh, she's good. You know, I'm happy to see her on screen. And I hadn't seen her in much before Alice in Wonderland. She may have made movies before Alice in Wonderland, but I will give Tim Burton credit for spotting her talent and saying, let's make her the lead of this movie, even though he gives her nothing to do. Aside from that casting, I can't think of one thing about this movie that works. I think every single other thing about the movie is misconceived.
I can tell you one more decision that they made.
All right.
I think it was a good decision. Having Christopher Lee as the voice of the Jabberwocky.
Sure. Okay.
That's it. That's all I got.
I'll give you that. She had made several films, by the way, prior to this. In fact, a whole bunch. But for whatever reason, this was the first thing I ever saw her in. So it looks like a lot of them are short films. She was in That Evening Sun. I didn't see it. She was in Rogue. Would that be the giant alligator Rogue? Yeah, it totally is. I haven't seen Rogue, the Australian giant alligator movie. So she had done some stuff, but I guess Tim Burton brought her to Hollywood, maybe?
I don't know.
Whatever, it's fine.
Nor do I really care, to be honest, because it doesn't...
So where do we even... I mean, where do I start talking about all of the things that are wrong with this movie?
Well, first of all, there's no, like, thumbprint on this movie. What, like, you're talking about... Like, there's no hallmarks of Tim Burton in this movie that it... Like, what happened? Where did he go? Who directed this movie?
Oh, I think there are. I mean, I think he has paid a lot of attention to the visual style. In fact, I think all of his attention went to the visual style. And he takes that approach for most movies, and sometimes it pays off. I mean, the thing about Tim Burton is he's an interesting stylist, or can be an interesting stylist, but generally a bad storyteller. And so Batman gets a lot of credit for the way it looks, the way it feels, but it's bad storytelling, you know? Like, I don't think it's a particularly well-told story in terms of who the characters are and what happens. Even Beetlejuice, which is a movie I like, I think is more kind of a triumph of art direction and Michael Keaton's character and a weird kind of sense of humor. But if you're just breaking down, like, what is the story of this movie, I take that back. There's some stuff that works. I mean, the journey that Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis go through to sort of have a family by the end of the film, that's kind of moving, so that kind of works. But I just think he's a bad storyteller. Nowhere is that more on display than in Alice in Wonderland. And so he really seems to have put all of his effort into the visual style. But I'll agree with you that it feels completely impersonal. It feels like somebody imitating what they think a Tim Burton movie would look like. It's Tim Burton imitating himself.
Okay. I don't see any Tim Burton in this, but that maybe it's just me. The things that I associate him, maybe some of the architecture to an extent, but there's none of the trademark. I don't think there's any of the trademark, like, black and white stripy stuff. There's none of the big head on the queen. Like, what is this we have to go ahead?
The work was done after that. You know what I mean? Like, we'll give her a giant head, and is somehow enough, and she will shout her performance. But then that gives way to this idea that all of her subjects have to be repulsive-looking automatons who all want to seem like they are all defective, too. So somebody has big ears, somebody has a big nose, somebody has a big stomach, because they don't want to be beheaded by this horrible person. But it looks, it's just so ugly and not in an interestingly tacky way. It's just ugly. All of the color has been drained from the film. And again, it doesn't want to give you, like, the fun, crazy Wonderland that you see in the Disney cartoon, because this is the post-apocalyptic Wonderland where all of the color has been bled out because it's Underland, and nowhere, you know, is that exemplified more, I think, than in the design of the Mad Hatter. I'm not positive if this is specifically the moment where Johnny Depp, like, really stopped caring, stopped trying, or when it was, like, no longer any fun to see him show up in a movie, but this was the movie I really feel like that exposed the great lie of Johnny Depp. You know what I mean? That it's a costume and a voice and an affect and not a performance. And I say that as someone who, you know, I know that Johnny Depp can give good performances.
Right.
I know that he has given good performances. So I'm not saying, like, the guy can never act and it's all a sham and this exposes it, but
right, it's become the crutch that has become, like, that's all it is. Like, he is the crutch now.
Yes.
For me, it was the Willy Wonka movie that did that.
You're right. And that movie did come before this one. So, yeah, that would be the one.
And I had forgot, like I told you, like, I didn't remember that until you said that. I had pushed it out of my brain because it took a movie that I mean, the book and the movie, the Gene Wilder one, and it just, I don't know, I felt like it took a dump on it. Kind of like this takes a big dump on Alice in Wonderland. I don't have much of a problem with Johnny Depp in this movie. I don't necessarily think it's good, but I think he's doing what he does now, which is show up do a voice, make the teenage girls swoon, and collect his check. That's all that's asked of him more often than not, and that's what he shows up and does.
I guess I take a bigger issue with it, maybe because he's the big star, maybe it's because the marketing was kind of built around him, or maybe it's because this is a character that he might have been able to make interesting or to kind of steal the movie. And I think for a lot of people he does. I think a lot of people love this movie because they love the Mad Hatter. And you go to conventions and there are people, typically girls, doing Mad Hatter cosplay. Yeah. But I, for the life of me, and this is just a matter of taste, cannot figure out what they are responding to, because I find the design terrible and the execution just as bad, if not worse. And again, I just a little bit of reading some on like Wikipedia where he tries to explain the decisions about how hatters once upon a time would get mercury poisoning because they would use mercury to cure the felt in the hats. Right. And the mercury is working itself out and it turned his hair orange. And that's why he's crazy, because he has mercury poisoning. I hate every single thing about what he's saying. And it's just like, no, just be the Mad Hatter. Like, give a performance that is memorable, that has joy in it, that speaks to the things that we like about that character. But this movie is determined to not give you any of the things that you like about Alice in Wonderland. It's basically telling you, like, kind of fuck you if you like these things, and it's going to go out of its way to make you not like those things that you are. This is the movie that tells you you're wrong to like those things, and here's why. Yeah.
Did you read on Wikipedia also, because I read that stuff
Anne
too,
Hathaway?
Did you read?
Is it Anne Hathaway? Are you going to say
no!
Anne Hathaway?
No, it's where Tim Burton said that he never had an emotional connection to the original Alice in Wonderland, so he made this movie so he would have emotional connections to the characters. What?! He said that.
The fact that he had no emotional connection to the characters is very evident.
But there's no there are no characters in this movie.
Well, that's the thing. To say that somehow, like, you made this movie to connect emotionally. On what level? Again, poor Mia Wasikowska, because I think she's trying, but, like, she's just glum. Her one expression is glum. And I just, it's weird to me to see a fairy tale reimagined as something so monochromatic and glum and joyless, when I don't think that's what he's trying to... I don't think that's the story he's trying to tell. Do you know what I mean? I don't think it's about revealing the dark underside of the traditional fairy tale. Which, by the way, I'm not interested in anyone ever making that movie. Like, Into the Woods tries to do some of that. You think you know this story? Think again. It's actually about pain and misery, and here you go.
And kids like that because they feel like it's something that, like, they're...
Being treated like grown-ups.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. And so maybe that's why this movie is so popular. I don't know.
Maybe so.
I cannot fucking figure it out. To me... Oh, so the Anne Hathaway thing, by the way, is... I can't stand her performance. I don't like, again, the conception of it. I don't understand what she's doing. It's this weird performance in air quotes. Everyone is in a different movie. All of those movies are bad. She describes... hold on, just make sure that you're ready to throw up. Her interpretation of the White Queen, she describes as a punk rock vegan pacifist with inspiration drawn from Debbie Harry, Greta Garbo, and the artwork of Dan Flavin. I'm just reading this from Wikipedia.
Well,
but, like, what?
See, this I'm is glad she feels that way.
It's this kind of stuff that makes me hate actors, because, yeah, like, do you really need to create this rich backstory for your four scene portrayal of the White Queen? And do you need to draw inspiration from Debbie Harry and Greta Garbo? And in what way are those inspirations evident on screen? Like, I don't know, when Johnny Depp tells me, or not tells me, when he announces that he's doing Angela Lansbury for his portrayal of Ichabod Crane, like, to me, that's kind of funny, you know, like, ha ha ha, and I could see that. That comes through in the performance. But this thing where you're a punk rock vegan pacifist, like, this movie can never stop fucking off. To me, and I don't know if this is still true because I don't see, and I know people love it.
Yeah.
But I don't hear people talking about it as much as I once did. But for me, there were a couple years there where, like I said, there were girls doing Alice in Wonderland cosplay and talking about how much they loved the movie. For me, this was, to a certain type of girl, what the Boondock Saints is to a certain type of guy.
Oh, snap!
It was like the female equivalent of Alice in Wonderland, which again is not to say that boys can't love Alice in Wonderland and girls can't love Boondock Saints, because I know that they do. But there was something parallel about the fandom that I saw for both films.
Wow. That's... okay.
Is there anything else about the movie that you like?
Let me consult my notes here.
you think, well, that's not horrible.
Aside from the Jabberwocky, which I thought was cool for the 3 minutes that it was on screen with no explanation really.
But again, this is a retelling of Alice in Wonderland that ends with a dragon being beheaded.
Right.
Like, if that's the movie you want to make, don't make Alice in Wonderland. You know what I mean? And again, I'm somebody who has apologized in the past for... Snow White and the Huntsman, and I would put it up against this movie any day of the week, and I could sit there and tell you why Snow White and the Huntsman is a better movie than Alice in Wonderland. I cannot convince you that it is a good movie.
That's fine.
Right, exactly. I like it, but I can certainly make a case for why it's a much better movie than Alice in Wonderland, and it makes the same stupid mistake of taking this beloved female fairy tale character and putting her in a suit of armor at the end of the movie and having her lead a battle. And this is because... this is what modern filmmakers, studio executives, that's what they see as female empowerment. That in order to present, because, you know, some of these Disney characters are outdated. They're waiting for their prince to come along to be saved. And yes, we as a more enlightened society now are looking for greater examples of female representations on screen.
But did Alice need to be updated? We should talk about the original. Like, are you familiar with the original Disney cartoon?
I have seen it. I'm not well-versed.
Okay, I watched it, I don't know, maybe a year ago. And to my memory, like, Alice is fine. Like, there's no chauvinism against her in that movie. Like, there's no need for a suit of armor to put her in. It seems more like a statement of where we are at now with movies in general, where everything has to be, in the finger quotes again, epic, and everything has to have some big battle.
Everything ends with a battle. Doesn't matter what it is. Yeah. If it's Alice in Wonderland, it's ending with a battle. I can't wait till Dumbo ends with a battle.
I know. Well, they're just going to beat the shit out of the elephant for an hour, and then he's going to, like, take off and fly, and then come back and strafe them with a machine gun or something. But, like, we take the Hobbit book that is a charming children's tale and we make it into 9 hours of war. Like, this is where we're at. I don't understand. So after we watch the... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
After we watched the movie last night, I turn to the child that told me this movie is great. And she's like, what did you think? I was like, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't really like it. She was like, well, can you tell me some reasons why? Because she's growing up in our house. So this is how she talks. She's like,
you said, listen, dear, the podcast comes out Wednesday.
So I said, well, I don't really understand what happened or why it happened. I saw a lot of things on the screen, but I don't know why any of it happened, and that troubles me. And I said, can you tell me why you think some of it happened? And she thought for a while, and there was no answer coming forth. Which reminds me of something that George Lucas said recently at Sundance. This past one, they did a conversation with George Lucas. And he said that movies now are circus movies or circus pictures. And you go to the circus movie to see the guy on the tightrope. And you're waiting for the splat. But there's nothing in that guy on a tightrope that's telling a story. You're just watching a guy on a tightrope. And that's where movies are at now. And George Lucas is right, Patrick.
So if we had known, like, what the guy on the tightrope's situation was in terms of tax representation or trade embargoes with other circuses or people on tightropes, would that make it a more compelling tightrope walk?
Maybe if we knew why he was on the tightrope and if he was trying to get away from something on the other side of the tightrope. Uh-huh. I feel like you're taking this and you're turning it against me.
I'm turning it against George Lucas.
He said, he was like, you know, I know that people blame me for this, but I just made the tools.
I don't blame him for ruining movies. I just blame him for the Star Wars prequels.
Hold on. To speak to that.
Yes.
It's the same thing that we're talking about with Tim Burton, which is guys who make movies that are more interested in the what than in the how. The story of it isn't nearly as interesting to them. It's just making this thing, like putting visuals.
Decorating the frame.
There you go.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly Lucas's issue. And it's certainly Tim Burton's issue. And I would argue that both of them are not very good at it. Lucas for different reasons, because Lucas's frame is too busy and there's not a ton of stuff to look at that draws the eye. Although every once in a while, you know, there will be a more interesting composition or at least a Darth Maul that's, you know, a very striking character. There's nothing in Alice in Wonderland to me that is interesting to look at or that draws the eye or that I think is even a particularly good special effect. I mean, it's not that it's bad, but
I thought they were bad.
And the Jabberwocky, I think, was okay.
Yeah.
Little rabbit is okay, but
Well, I was trying to decide if it was supposed to look as artificial as it did.
Well, I mean, yeah, because there are things like the Cheshire Cat or that dog thing, the name of which I can't remember. The names throughout the movie, by
Bander.
The way.
Vander something.
I hate all of the names, and maybe they come from Lewis Carroll. I don't know, but I hate almost all of the names in the movie.
You hate literature.
I do. This movie made me hate literature and books of all kind. Yeah, I thought a lot of the CGI creations looked like bad sort of late 90s, early 2000s CGI, and we've come a long way in that time. I know that may sound like I'm making fun of something from 10 years ago, but the CGI from early 2000s looks very crude in comparison to what is being done now. And yeah, I thought not only were the designs uninspired, but that the execution was kind of poorly done as well.
Yeah. It's like a step above VeggieTales, if you know what that is. Like, it's not that great. Like, see, the queen puts her feet up on that pig, and the pig looks like something out of a video game from 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know what movie he wanted to make, and I want to believe, well, his heart wasn't in it, and yet this movie was so insanely successful that it gave him kind of carte blanche to do anything. And then, of course, he made Dark Shadows, which has many of the same problems, although I think I like Dark Shadows better than this movie. And Dark Shadows is not good, but I think it's a better movie than Alice in Wonderland.
It has Alice Cooper in it. So
it has Alice Cooper. It has Eva Green.
Oh, yeah.
It has a couple of scenes that aren't the worst thing you've ever seen, unlike Alice in Wonderland, which contains only the worst things you've ever seen. I feel bad because this is literally just a bitch fest, but I'm kind of out of ideas. I don't know what to say about a movie that is so expensive and so successful and yet just lays there dead on the screen, actively pissing me off, not attempting to tell any kind of story to bring anything new to the world except to say that, like, after the events of Alice in Wonderland, this children's story that you love, everything was terrible. And the Queen of Hearts beheaded many people in her kingdom, including a frog, begging not to be murdered because who will look after his family? And this is in the Disney movie called Alice in Wonderland. Do you know what I mean? Like, who is the audience for this movie? Because it seems like it's supposed to be a family movie, and yet this is a movie that hates you. And sometimes Tim Burton's sort of anger at the world, and I think he's an angry guy. I don't, you know, it doesn't come across in his interviews or whatever, but I think some of his movies express such hostility. Look at Batman Returns. You just talked about that, I think, last week. That's an angry movie. Absolutely. A very angry movie.
Which is probably why I like it as much as I do.
Again, at least it has a point of view, you know?
Yeah.
So this
Sweeney
movie,
Todd. Sweeney Todd is an angry movie.
It's an angry movie. And this, I mean, I would argue that Mars Attacks is an angry movie.
Yeah.
This seems like an angry movie, and not in a way that, I don't think it communicates that anger particularly well, like I might say Batman Returns does. I think Batman Returns gets that message across. I think Alice in Wonderland even manages to fumble the anger. So what's left is just ugliness and despair posing as energy and joy.
Do you think that that, what you just described, is now the exception or the rule at the box office?
It's hard to say. I mean,
it's getting close, right?
Yes, but at the same time, you know, Transformers Age of Extinction was one of the highest grossing films of last year. I think it fits that bill.
absolutely.
But beating it out was Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
Which I think actively works against those qualities, and I think is about energy and is about joy and is about having a positive message and telling a story and presenting characters that are memorable and fun to spend time with. It's also beaten out by the Hunger Games, what's the last one? Mockingjay Part 1, which I haven't seen still.
Not me either.
And I will obviously concede to anyone who complains about the cynicism of splitting the book into two books so that we can have, you know, a 5-hour battle instead of just a 2.5-hour battle. And I would agree with that. And obviously that speaks of cynicism, but I haven't loved the Hunger Games movies, but I don't think they're guilty of these things that we're saying.
Okay.
And just recently, American Sniper actually overtook all of those movies to become the highest grossing movie of 2014. And again, I'm no fan of American Sniper. I don't think it fits any of those categories either. So of the four highest grossing movies, I think really only Transformers is guilty of it. But I will absolutely agree with you that a lot of kind of cynical blockbusters do seem to be born out of that same model.
It's a disturbing trend that seems to be on the rise. And now with the announcement of Dumbo, I cannot imagine what a Tim Burton Dumbo is going to look like.
The only thing I can that I can picture is him going back to sort of his early days, which is all of his movies were about a misfit who is misunderstood by the world and sort of mocked, and who eventually maybe finds his place in the world. You know, it's Jack Skellington, it's Pee-wee, it's Edward Scissorhands, especially. And that's Dumbo. I mean, you know, Dumbo is quote unquote a freak. And hopefully he just doesn't go too hard on that angle and makes this movie slightly more suitable for children and or families.
I want to present the world with a goth Dumbo.
That's actually a very good Tim Burton.
I just feel like we haven't connected to how dark Dumbo could get.
This is my new favorite thing. You have to only do podcasts now as Tim Burton.
Okay, all right.
We're going to have you doing Tim Burton. Risky's going to do Michael Rapaport. And Mike can do Timothy Dalton, and we're just going to do an all-celebrity edition of F This Movie.
That sounds fantastic.
I don't do any celebrities convincingly, sadly, so I'll have to brush up on someone. Anything left in the tank?
I don't think so.
No.
I have no, like, now I'm super depressed about the future of movies.
No, I really do think that, like, this is kind of an anomaly. I really do. I think it's rare. The Transformers movies are certainly, movies that we point to a lot as being terrible movies that somehow make billions of dollars. And that's unfortunate. And as much as I want to believe, like, yeah, but it's happening overseas, right? No, they still make hundreds of millions of dollars here in the United States. But I do think with, the success of Guardians of the Galaxy, with the success of the Avengers, which I think is very different, than Alice in Wonderland, with the success of something like the Fast and Furious franchise, or even, and I'm not saying this to start a fight, I think the two Sony Amazing Spider-Man films are flawed in many of the ways that some of the movies that we're talking about are. Maleficent, Alice in Wonderland, a little bit. I think they share some flaws. I think they're better movies. I'm not arguing that point.
That's okay. It's okay.
But the
You
fact,
son of a
but
bitch!
the fact that we've seen kind of a course correction, you know what I mean? That somebody said, like, oh, people weren't really liking these movies. Let's try something different that seems to have everybody's best interests at heart. It's not like let's continue on with this Spider-Man shared universe that nobody wanted. Let's try to get the character back in good hands and do right by it and go back to making a Spider-Man movie that people like, because that hasn't happened in over a decade now. Spider-Man 2 was the last Spider-Man movie that people liked.
Yeah, that's true. That weren't named Heath Allen.
Right. So, or Andrew Garfield. So, I do feel like Alice in Wonderland is an exception more than a rule. I think that there are lots of bad movies coming out. I think they're bad in lots of different ways, in some of the same ways. But I think the unique terribleness of Alice in Wonderland is something of an anomaly.
I hope that that is true.
And
That act, you've given me hope again.
yes.
I had the knife to my wrist, but now.
And with that message of positivity, I send you all back out into the world to track down the 8 or 9 movies that we talked about at the beginning of this episode, and to continue to avoid Alice in Wonderland forever if you have not seen it yet. I had asked a question a couple of weeks ago for our weekend question, like, how many chances do you give a director? Do you ever give up on a director? And I didn't answer it myself. And the truth is, I don't ever give up on a director. I will continue to see Michael Bay movies because every time I'll think, maybe this is the one. Maybe this time he changes it. And, it wasn't Pearl Harbor when it seemed like he was going to do something different. It wasn't Transformers. I thought when the original Transformers was coming out, I thought, well, this seems to be in his wheelhouse, and with the help of Steven Spielberg, surely he can stick this landing. No, he can't. It wasn't Pain and Gain, which everyone said, here's Michael Bay doing something different. So I've been burned over and over and over again. I will continue to see his movies. And the same goes for Tim Burton. There are very few Tim Burton movies in the last 10 to 15 years that I like. The difference is, for me, I won't ever just give up on a director. I won't ever swear one off and say, no more chances for you. I just won't get excited about a new Tim Burton, whereas once I used to. I don't really get excited about a new Kevin Smith like I did when I was 19 and he was making, kind of good movies. I still will see any movie that Kevin Smith makes. I may not rush out to see it right away. It may take me some time, and I'm just not going to be excited about it. But I will never swear off a director.
And that's the zone, boys and girls, where we spend most of our time. Just not getting excited. It's best to live your life without excitement.
That's right. And with that, thank you, Heath, for talking about this movie with me, and I'm sorry.
Thank you for having me on to talk about it. Hey, now I've seen it, which is always better than not having seen it.
Except in this case, thank you guys all for listening. Next week we will be back. If things go according to plan, I will be joined by Adam Riske for a discussion of 1991's Backdraft. So get your fireman gear ready. And Heath, I leave you with the final word.
Well, I'm going to go work on my Dumbo storyboards.